Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you back to the time of Constantine in part four of our series by the title of The Vatican Centuries. Joining an art expert who comments on Michelangelo's depiction of David and Goliath up on the spandrel of the Sistine Chapel. And joining our popular lover of all things Latin, who this week takes us on an exclusive guided tour of the Colosseum. Thanks so much for joining me once again. As announced a moment ago, it's time for part four in our series, The Vatican Centuries, a programme written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, in which we take you back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican down the centuries. In the last episode, you heard how the apostles, Peter and Paul, were martyred in Rome, and how Peter's burial place became a centre of pilgrimage, and in time the heart of the Christian Church. Today we move on to the time of Constantine, who turned the Vatican into a building site, the focal point of which was St. Peter's tomb. Stay tuned.
The Roman Empire was moving ever closer to collapse. The 3rd century was characterized by anarchy and civil war. The Emperor Diocletian attempted to salvage the crumbling state by overhauling the administration and dividing the empire into east and west.
History has shown that Christianity was not even indirectly responsible for the decline and fall. The rot had set in already.
Yet at this time it was seen to be a danger. The pernicious error of the Christians, declared an edict of the time, has thrown the whole universe into confusion.
And so Christians lived through the worst persecution the Church had known. The popes were killed or exiled. The clergy were imprisoned. The sacred books were burnt. Christian property was confiscated.
Until one day, a young man saw a vision, and Rome became a Christian city.
The young man was Constantine.
Born in the Roman province of Moesia in the year 288 AD, son of Constantius Chlorus and Helena, Constantine was educated in the East and served as a soldier under Diocletian and Galerius. On his father's death in York in 306, the legions acclaimed Constantine emperor, but Galerius only granted him the title of Caesar, or sub-emperor of the West. The other contender was Maxentius.
In 312, the two engaged in battle at the Milvian Bridge. Constantine was victorious. Afterwards, he told of the vision he had seen in the sky, a cross with the words, "With this sign, conquer." Constantine had the cross inscribed on the shields of his troops, and the day was his.
The African rhetorician Lactantius, who was tutor to Constantine's eldest son, has left us an account of the historic battle at the Milvian Bridge.
Already civil war had broken out between Constantine and Maxentius. Although Maxentius remained at Rome, an oracle had predicted that he would die if he crossed the city gates, the war was conducted by his able commanders. His forces were superior to those of his adversary. They clashed, and Maxentius' troops held the advantage up until the time when Constantine, prepared either to win or to die, brought all his forces close to Rome and encamped near the Milvian Bridge. It was near the 28th of October, the anniversary of Maxentius' accession to the throne and the celebration of his completion of 5 years of reign. During his sleep, Constantine was directed that God's heavenly sign should be inscribed on the soldiers' shields before they should begin the battle. He did as he was commanded, and he had inscribed on the shields the name of Christ by means of an X that was crossed by an I curved over at the top. Armed with this sign, his soldiers stood to arms, and the hand of God was stretched over the fray.
Constantine was now supreme in the West. He met Licinius, victor in the East, and together they issued the Edict of Milan, which granted religious freedom to all.
Constantine himself did not immediately become a Christian. Indeed, he was only baptized on his deathbed. But he protected Christianity and did all he could to promote it. He was no saint, but he was an acute statesman and saw in the new religion a force and a unity which was what the empire needed. He opted for Christianity.
Right from the start, he concerned himself with the controversies of the early church. He attempted to heal the breach between the Christians of the Roman Church and the Donatists. And in 325, he called the first ecumenical council at Nicaea in Asia Minor to combat the Arian heresy.
Around the year 328, he had the seat of the empire transferred to Byzantium, which he wanted to call New Rome, but which became, inevitably, Constantinople. 3 years before he died, in 337, Constantine proclaimed Christianity the state religion. Christian Rome was born.
Some years before he left Rome for the East, the first Christian emperor performed an historic task. On the Vatican Hill, for many centuries, had stood a temple to Apollo. In the year 323 AD, Constantine destroyed the pagan temple and erected the first Basilica of St. Peter's.
Just what did Constantine see when he decided to build a basilica over Peter's tomb? A small pillared shrine, or memorial. In the upper part, there was an opening into which pilgrims put their heads when they prayed. In the lower half, there was a hole into which they let down handkerchiefs and other small objects to be sanctified by contact with the apostle's tomb.
According to the 8th century Liber Pontificalis, Constantine exhumed the body of Peter in the presence of Pope Sylvester. He then enshrined it in a silver case enclosed within a sarcophagus of Cyprian brass. Over this he placed a large gold cross weighing 150 pounds. He then restored the body to its original tomb, over which he erected an altar and a vaulted chamber, faced on the inside with plates of gold.
A thought which might occur to the practical modern mind is, why did Constantine build his basilica on the slope of a hill? Obviously at great cost and labour, when there must have been plenty of other, more reasonable sites available.
The answer is simple. At the time, there was still an ancient horror of disturbing the dead, so that rather than move the tomb elsewhere, Constantine cut into the side of the hill and built a vast platform on the lower slope, leaving St. Peter's tomb as the central feature of his building. The shrine stood isolated above the pavement of the basilica, until later the high altar was built over it.
Constantine did, in fact, commit the act of violatio sepulchri, for he dug down into the ancient cemetery beneath the hill and disturbed a great number of tombs, some of which he even cut off at the top of their vaulting.
No doubt he salved his conscience by explaining that the end justified the means, and, we are told, even worked on the building himself, carrying away, in a symbolic gesture, 12 basket loads of earth in honour of the 12 apostles.
If you enjoyed part 4 of the Vatican Centuries, be sure to tune in at this same time next week for the next in this series of programmes, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. And now, why not go to the heart of the Vatican, the Sistine Chapel, where our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, is about to give us an on-air illustration of one of Michelangelo's greatest masterpieces there. So, Breda, we're going to speak about David and Goliath.
Yes.
In one of the spandrels of the Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
It's obviously by Michelangelo.
It's up above the entrance to the Sistine Chapel. So these are the two scenes that you see up in the two corners. Like almost holding the ceiling together stopping it from falling into the chapel. You always get this sense when you look at these triangles, the four of them holding up all of the work on the top, at each end, at the four corners of the Sistine Chapel. So David and Goliath is one of the two that you can see as you enter. On the right-hand side you have David and Goliath, and the other side you have Judith. But we're going to talk here about David and Goliath. But they do have one thing in common, that they are a kind of a moral warning to those entering the chapel, because they are symbols of divine justice. So both, with their humility and wisdom and strength, serve the function of warning those of what can happen if the law of God is not observed. So there's a sort of prophetic sense here, and also the salvation of man coming through the Messiah because of the inhuman feats that they performed. Now, going back to David and Goliath, you have the war between the Philistines and the Israelites, and Goliath is looking for somebody to challenge him. The giant Goliath is looking for someone to challenge him in a duel. And of course, nobody wants to do this. So little David decides he's going to be brave and comes forward and manages to kill the giant. It's a strange scene. It's almost abstract in a way, because at the bottom part you see what could be a rock, brownish coloured rock, or certainly is the earth. You have the giant lying literally right across scene, gigantic, obviously. And David is right above him, and he's in the act of cutting off his head, but he hasn't yet done so. So it's interesting, he grabs the giant by the hair. You can see his hand going into the hair and pulling at it. Just to keep him under control. The giant is dressed in green, and the sleeves of his garment are a sort of an orange and white stripe. It's a very strange combination of colours there, actually. But I think it also helps to give more power to the scene, because those stripes, those little orange stripes, you can see in the tent also behind David. So there are certain links there. Your eye goes up one line and goes through David and goes into another line behind him. Now, the giant is falling down. David is dressed in blue and a green, which is like, it's a kind of gauge green in a sense, and very delicate green, whereas the colours worn by the giant are rougher, less finished colours, let's say. Then behind the two figures, you have this extraordinary tent, which is obviously the kind of tent you would have on normal battlefields anyway. But Michelangelo has painted it in such a way that it gives a kind of breath to the scene. It gives David a beautiful background, because the tent, the bottom part of the tent is white, and it curves around and it goes into, it's going into another triangle. It's almost like the tent itself will become a triangle, even though you can't see the top of the tent, which is outside the painting, let's say. and then you can see the orange part on the top with the lines, and you can get the feeling that there's a light inside the tent. So this is all helping to illuminate David in the moment when he is about to cut the head off the giant. Now, hidden in the back, on each side, behind the ground or rock or whatever, are the soldiers who are looking on in disbelief and horror. That how can this possibly be happening? So they're absolutely amazed. Michelangelo manages to do a lot of this work without doing too much detail. It's extraordinary the way you have, for example, the face of David has a lot of detail. And you can really see his expression and his concentration. His clothes are also very detailed. The giant, you can't see his face, but his hair is very detailed and the light is falling on his head. So that means that anybody looking at this piece from the ground will see that David is grabbing his hair. So you don't have any doubt as to what's happening there. Then Michelangelo has painted one of the hands of the giant, almost like it's just like an abstract piece, just a shape. But it's not a detailed hand. The other hand is very detailed. And again, you look at the feet of the giant, the one foot that you can actually see. Again, it's very chunky and not particularly detailed either. The soldiers, the ones on the right-hand side, are very clearly defined. The ones on the left, not so. You get the feeling that the scene goes around inside. He has been able to create a sense of space that you can imagine the space that's beyond the space that he's painting in. The whole story of this, obviously, is the triumph of good over evil. Which obviously is the entire message of the Sistine Chapel. It's the entire message of the Old and New Testament. This is where Michelangelo is able to let us in to his way of explaining the theology of the body through his attempts at trying to express with visual figure God's message to us.
My thanks there go to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, for sharing with us her expertise in the field of sacred art. Professor Ennis is currently teaching fine arts at the American University of Rome. Finally, time to go out and about once again, this time not inside the Vatican, but a little further afield to Rome's Colosseum, where I once persuaded our lover of all things Latin, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, to take me on a guided tour. Let's listen as we potter around there.
Okay, the original was like the biggest thing that was left from Roman times. What we see here has half disappeared. The two outer walls you see are broken off right in front of us.
There are three levels of arches right in front of us.
Three walls in and three levels up.
They have columns of the different orders, the Doric, the Ionic,
and Corinthian. up on top.
And the Corinthian up on top. And then there's a fourth level, which we can't actually see except for a little bit from here.
The scaffolding, that was added by Titus, like some bleachers up there for standing spectators. Maybe for people just interested in stories, most people don't know where the idea of Colosseum comes from. And right across from us to the left over there where you see those trees, where the people are sitting there, there's a square that was put up by the Italian archaeologists. Well, that's the basis or the foundation of a colossal statue of Nero.
So that's where the Colosseum got its name.
So the fact is, where the Colosseum is today was an artificial lake inside or around the house, in front of the house of Nero. And he had this massive statue, which was perhaps as tall as the Colosseum is today, built in his honor. And so that stood there for several hundred years. And the emperors used to change the head, but keep the body and just change the head as they came and went. So it was this colossal statue, because you see
Colossal Colosseum.
It was the Colossus of Nero, and therefore what was next to the Colossus of Nero was the Colosseum. But you see the Latin inscription right in front of us, Pius IX there, is Amphitheatrum Flavium, the Flavian Amphitheater. That's the technical name. Because the father and the two sons, Vespasian, Titus, well, Domitian a little later, the dynasty of the three Flavian emperors are responsible. They're responsible for the Colosseum.
Why did they build it? I know that there are all kinds of legends connected to the Colosseum.
Well, one of the ideas, of course, even Julius Caesar had the idea of a Colosseum like this. Augustus had plans for it, but he never finished it. So there were ideas in the Roman mind to have a theater for the people, because there was really no one theater. Under the influence of Hollywood, you have the impression that Nero and all these other guys had games in the Colosseum. Of course, the Colosseum came after Nero. So they had portable theaters, or they used to have gladiatorial matches out in the streets in a certain sense.
So all the wild beasts and animals they talk about.
That started with the Colosseum, really. And they said it took 3 months to dedicate this Colosseum. About 3,000 different animals were killed around here. Rhinoceroses, all that other stuff, lions and elephants and stuff from North Africa. That's why North Africa doesn't have any animals today, because the Romans cleared the whole thing out.
But they brought them along in ships.
Oh, yeah, they right in here. For this dedication, we have a famous Latin poet, Martialis, who describes the games used for the celebration, some horrible things. When we go here with the students, I tell them the Colosseum is a monument to Roman architecture, but it's not a monument to Roman civilization.
And to Christianity?
No, neither. I'll tell you why. Because what went on there was really no credit to anyone. Gory, terrible games.
What happened here was a disgrace.
Well, yeah, because the Romans were very crude, you know. I mean, I love Latin. It's my whole life. But, I mean, their culture was very crude. The Greeks had, you know, the fine games, you know, the Olympic games, light and races. What the Romans thought was pleasurable or delightful was really a disgrace. I mean, the more blood and the more horror went on, the more the people were delighted. If you read some of the stuff, even Martial's poems, about what went on, they thought it was a funny thing. For example, they would have a pregnant pig come out in the middle and kind of drive the pig so crazy that she would give birth out on the... And they thought, the Romans thought, this was a sign of fertility and a sign of the grace of the gods. And of course, you know, the different animals and stuff, and they said at one point that the elephants would kneel down in front of the emperor almost like crying, because they kind of knew what was happening to them, and they were being tormented by these things, gladiators and the picadores you'd have to do. It's like the bullfights today, got it? And they would train the elephants, and sometime, and it was a terrible thing, on one occasion the people stood up and booed the emperor because the elephants started crying. I mean, the whole thing that went on here was really kind of awful. It goes against everything we think is kind of decent today, except maybe wrestling or something like that.
It goes against everything Christian.
Well, yeah, so every kind of decency today. I mean, what they thought was funny and pleasurable was just terrible. was horrible, that's all. See, the place is beautiful, but what went on is bad.
Father, I can see there's a cross just opposite here. Why is there a cross on what could be a pagan amphitheater?
Well, yeah, I can see the Latin inscription here says this is Pius IX, a very nice thing in 1852. Yeah, that's right. He says this amphitheater dedicated to the gods by impious religion, and he says, and reborn from this bad superstition by the blood of the martyrs. And so the idea was with the Christians, they still thought that there were these masses of Christian martyrs here who reconsecrated the Colosseum to the true God after it had been used for false gods for so many centuries. So that's written all in Latin. If people understand Latin, you're going to understand. I can read this from here. In the fourth line it says it was reborn by the blood of the martyrs. So kind of transferred. So the Christians came along and said, okay, this is our place now.
Is that why the Pope today leads the Stations of the Cross on Good Friday
one
here?
One of the reasons. You have to understand also that until the Italians took over things in the 1890s, 1900 here, you had a whole city inside here. St. Philip Neri started Stations of the Cross in the Colosseum. There were two churches, two chapels in the Colosseum dedicated to the martyrs. All that stuff was torn out. So way before this present Pope came around, the Colosseum had churches and had the Way of the Cross inside.
Actually had churches inside.
Well, there were two chapels on both sides. That was all demolished. Who's another famous? Laboré. He, like the poor man who lived in Rome here, he lived inside here.
The Frenchman.
Yes, exactly. And so, and as I say, Philip Neri set up a Station of the Cross inside. So this goes way back to the 1500s. The tradition of the Station of the Cross in the Colosseum. You know, the
it was very helpful to pilgrims.
Oh yes. The famous man and with the poor and everything else, he was a pastor, you know, at St. John of the Florentines, right at the bridge there that goes over to the tunnel to the Vatican. He was the pastor over there for about 12, 13 years and was really an outstanding man as the shepherd of people. And so he started all kinds of things here.
Hospices for the pilgrims.
Yes, exactly. At a hospice in Trastevere, Philip Neri. And then he moved over to the oratory, Santa Maria Nuova, Chiesa Nuova today. And anyway, and so he started all these different devotions and everything else. A very interesting man.
And heartfelt thanks there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, for taking us on this exclusive tour of the Colosseum. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.